In the following recording by the L.A. Sound Posse, Dr. John Marciano continues his public seminar series with Empire as a Way of Life, a monthly lecture and discussion presented until June of 2007. Dr. Marciano says about Empire as a Way of Life, "A fundamental purpose of our meetings is to understand the systemic nature of the U.S. Empire and the economic and military imperialism that is its lifeblood." The historian William Appleman Williams argues that empire became a way of life in the U.S., a combination of patterns of thought and action that, as it becomes habitual and institutionalized, defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. This way of life has convinced many U.S. Americans they have a right or manifest destiny to impose their political and economic policies upon others. The lectures are given at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com.
As I mentioned, I hope people bear with me. It's been a stressful few weeks, and I've got a rib problem that's flared up as well. So if I have to stop for a minute and just take a break, I think I'll get through okay. This is shorter than usual because it's given our last class of the course of our group. I tried to keep it shorter so that I read this through as I do. I do a couple of readings, and then we'll take a short break, and then it'll give us a little more discussion, and we'll continue as we do at Izzy's. And we don't have to pass the hat tonight, given that we paid our last rental. So this is the last chapters on Williams, Grandin, and Parenti. So I will close this course tonight with a brief summary from the last chapters in Williams, Grandin, and Parenti, and reflections from other scholars, reviewing some again, given the nature of their arguments and this being our last session. In Williams' last chapter, Notes on Freedom Without Empire, he asserts that a critical approach to history begins with an honest reading of what we find in the mirror of our history, and proceeds as a continuous dialogue about how to be leaders and to promote the common welfare without being imperialist. A fundamental issue facing us is whether we can transcend the decades of propaganda to which we have been subjected and come up with an honest and objective reading of U.S. history that is not overwhelmed by our subjective conditioning and beliefs. Williams believed that citizens here lacked any idea of community beyond a system presided over by the U.S. as a benevolent policeman. A minimal understanding of actual U.S. history, however, reveals it has never been a benevolent policeman, but always violent to the point of genocide. The evidence supporting this thesis is easily found in the historical record. According to Williams, empire is expensive. It costs a very great deal of money. It kills a great number of human beings. It confines and progressively throttles spontaneity and imagination. It substitutes paranoid togetherness for community. End of his quote. The human, economic, and ecological costs, therefore, are clearly linked together rather than being separate entities. They have been staggering, especially for the victims of U.S. actions in the Third World, but also for those in this nation. The dilemma we face, Williams argues, is that this empire will continue to destroy this and other nations until we Americans confront the truth of our imperial way of life. If the past is any indication of the coming future, our long history as a nation state clearly suggests we are not likely to confront the truth. The ideologies of God and country, for example, are simply too powerful. Williams pleads that we need to turn away from empire and begin to create a community. At the very least, we must break free of the paranoia that defined all our problems as caused by external evil. The key to understanding empire is that it begins at home and is inherent to capitalism. It is not to be found in the nature of the old evil empire, terrorism, or revolutionary movements abroad. In his final chapter, Iraq is Not Arabic for Latin America, Greg Grandin connects the current U.S.-Iraq war with U.S. wars in Central America in the 1980s, beginning with his comments about U.S. officials and pundits who have been involved in and defended both imperialist assaults. He mentions Elliot Abrams, the man who in the 1980s so twisted the concept of human rights that it could justify the homicidal activities of the Contras and the Salvadoran military, being appointed by Bush II to lead a global crusade for democracy. Grandin also discusses accusations that John Negroponte's involvement in the cover-up of hundreds of executions while he was ambassador to Honduras in the 1980s made him unfit to serve as intelligence czar. The accusations against Negroponte are all true, and if justice prevailed, he would be in prison, having been convicted as an accessory to murder. Grandin points out that our violent history does nothing to douse the maddening zeal with which these new imperialists embrace the idea that the U.S. not only has the right, but the ability to order the world. This self-righteous zeal goes back to the city on the hill and the English colonists invaders who came here in the 17th century. Its form has changed, but the essential worldview remains. For example, Senator Trent Lott reflected this worldview when he defended the 1998 Iraqi Liberation Act that became official policy after being passed unanimously by the Senate. This is another fact of history that Democrats and liberals wish to drop down the memory hole. Lott reminded colleagues of the success of the Reagan Doctrine and U.S. patronage of the Contras by stating that we supported freedom fighters in Latin America willing to fight and die for a democratic future. Even trying to state words like that is making my rib even hurt more. The imperialist links between the policies in Central America and Iraq are quite powerful. Therefore, those challenging such policies had better understand these connections, lest amnesia force us into understanding one war at a time that is totally separate from any other imperialist venture. The militarist and murderous political officials and intellectuals who urge violence against the poor around the world, they did it then in Central America, they're doing it now with regards to Iraq and Afghanistan, are the core agents of the neo-fascist imperialism. They have brought death and devastation to millions abroad, but not one has had to face a 21st century Nuremberg tribunal. The possibility that their policies will lead us to an actual fascist state has been raised in a provocative article by Naomi Wolf in The Guardian of London this past April. She argues that if you look at history, you can see that there is essentially a blueprint for turning an open society into a dictatorship. That blueprint has been used again and again in more and less bloody, more and less terrifying ways. But it is always effective. It is very difficult and arduous to create and sustain a democracy, she argues, but history shows that closing one down is much simpler. You simply have to be willing to take certain steps. She goes on to argue that if you are willing to look, that each of these steps has already been initiated today in the United States by the Bush administration, which has used time-tested tactics to close down an open society. She continues, it is time for us to be willing to think the unthinkable, that it can happen here, and we are further along than we realize. These steps include invoking a terrifying and external enemy, creating a gulag, setting up an internal surveillance system, harassing citizens' groups that dissent from official policy, engaging in arbitrary detention and release, targeting key individuals, controlling the press, equating dissent with treason, and suspending the rule of law. She concludes on a very sober note. As Americans turn away quite leisurely, keeping tune to internet shopping and American Idol, the foundations of democracy are being fatally corroded in a context in which we are at war, in a long war, a war without end. Let's return to Grandin for a moment, who asked us to recall recent history from the 1980s, arguing that all of Bush's abuses of power today have their most immediate antecedents in Reagan's Central America policy, which in retrospect has to be understood as the first battle in the New Rights Crusade to roll back restrictions placed on the imperial presidency in the wake of Vietnam, Watergate, COINTELPRO, and other scandals of the 1970s. We must also not forget that these regressive efforts could not have succeeded without the active and/or silent support of Democrats and liberals. Grandin also reminds us of a fact that influences Parenti's work. The U.S.'s privileged position within the world's global financial system demands an aggressive foreign policy. On this fact, neither political party disagrees. This is an absolutely vital point that cannot be overstated. Leading Democrats have had no qualms about exploiting the poor in Latin America or engaging in aggression there or the Middle East. Concluding on a powerful note, Grandin states, like any empire before it, the U.S. will not tilt too far in favor of democracy at the expense of stability. The precarious misery generated by free market absolutism will predictably lead to challenges to U.S. interests and authority, and, just as predictably, they will have to be dealt with, as they were in Latin America, with an increasingly heavy hand. Talk of the Salvador option, that is, death squad regimes, in other words, is not an indication of the failure of Washington's imperial policy, but an admission of its essence. Therefore, what Hans shared with us last time bears repeating. Progressive struggles underway in Latin America clearly challenge U.S. imperial interests. As citizens within the empire, we will have to decide whether to support these struggles or the empire. In this epic conflict, there is no middle ground, no neutral and safe place. Michael Parenti concludes his book by agreeing with the Progressive magazine's blunt assessment of post-World War II U.S. foreign policy. The legacy for the U.S. is tragic, a permanently militarized conception of national security, agencies of covert action and undemocratic secrecy, prone to violation of individual rights and police state tactics incompatible with democracy, a huge inefficient bureaucracy, militarization of foreign policy, and redirection of resources away from humanitarian ends. Other than that, things are fantastic. It is not a pretty picture, merely a truthful one. The starting point for anyone who is serious about understanding this nation's foreign policy. To close my comments this evening, I wish to revisit and add the views of some scholars who complement the insights of Grandin, Parenti, and Williams. But first, we need to be reminded that these scholars all challenge the dominant elite view of U.S. international policy that has been found and is found in our schools and mass media, captured by the present George II, who has proclaimed our nation as the greatest force for good in history. He has praised the glories of the U.S. and the need to share these with the world. Despite its flaws, our nation is chosen by God and commissioned by history to be the model to the world of justice and inclusion and diversity without division. What a guy. This arrogant, triumphant, and uncritical view of the U.S. mission in the world was contested quite strongly by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz in her article, who bluntly linked the founding of the United States to a white supremacist, settler, colonialist, and imperialist aggressor state. Dunbar Ortiz named white supremacy as the working rationalization and ideology of English theft of Native American lands, and especially the justification for slavery. She also unsettled us with her claim that this white supremacist U.S. origin myth is itself closely tied to the parallel Afrikaner origin myth in South Africa and subsequent apartheid. White supremacy is not only the core premise of U.S. domestic and international policy from the origins to the present, it and imperialism are also inseparable from the content of this origin story and the definition of patriotism today. It began before the official founding of the nation and was not an accident or aberration in the progression of democracy. Dunbar Ortiz's thesis is that the United States has been fundamentally imperialist and racist from the beginning, and imperialism was not a divergence from a well-intentioned past. We didn't just stray from the wonderful city on the hill. That city was fundamentally and profoundly rotten from the beginning. In the unlearning process against empire that we must go through as citizens, we might well consider the insights of social theorist and writer Harry Magdoff, who was quoted at the end of her article. Citizens of an imperialist country who wish to understand imperialism must first emancipate themselves from the seemingly endless web of threads that bind them emotionally and intellectually to the imperialist condition. I also shared the views of scholar and filmmaker Felix Green, who wrote that the need for violence grows out of the basic aim of imperialism, and that aim is to make the maximum profits, to exploit, to dominate. Imperialism of necessity involves the defense of the social order out of which it developed. This is a key point often missed by critics of the means and results of imperialism that do not examine its essence or inherent qualities. Such insights are absolutely essential if we are to understand the link between the nature of the capitalist system internally and empire and exploitation abroad. Noam Chomsky, our leading intellectual dissident, asserted in his book World Orders Old and New that U.S. imperialism has sought to maintain the worldwide class division between North and South, which is far more important than the East-West Cold War conflict, in his view. A much more realistic understanding of the Cold War can be obtained by adopting a longer-range perspective, viewing it as a particular phase in the 500-year European conquest of the world, the history of aggression, subversion, terror, and domination, now termed the North-South confrontation. In another one of his books, The Culture of Terrorism, Chomsky discusses U.S.-supported genocidal and imperial violence against Central America that must be placed within the larger context of overall U.S. foreign policy. And I quote, "The central and not very surprising conclusion that emerges from the documentary and historical record is that U.S. international and security policy, rooted in the structure of power in the domestic society, has as its primary goal the preservation of what we might call the fifth freedom." Those of you who may remember FDR talked about the four freedoms at the beginning of World War II. Chomsky has added a fifth freedom, which he says is understood crudely but with a fair degree of accuracy as the freedom to rob, to exploit, and to dominate, to undertake any course of action to ensure that existing privilege is protected and advanced. The self-image of American elites, Chomsky writes, reveals the U.S. as a lawless and violent state and must remain so, independently of such nonsense as international law, the world court, the UN, or other international institutions. U.S. international terrorism is scandalous only if it infringes upon the prerogatives of the powerful or carries a potential cost to elite interests. Therefore, the successful use of terrorism is not considered a scandal. On the contrary, it is welcomed and applauded. The activist and writer Arundhati Roy provided us earlier in this our group with a brief summary of actual U.S. imperialist aggression throughout the world. Since the Second World War, the U.S. has been at war with or attacked, among other countries, Korea, Guatemala, Cuba, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, Grenada, Libya, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Panama, Iraq, Somalia, Sudan, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan. This list should also include the U.S. government's covert operations in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, the coups it has engineered, and the dictators it has armed and supported. This is why we're hated throughout the world. These guys have been busy the last 60 years. In a provocative article that addresses the issues we've examined in this course, Phyllis Bennis and Robert Jensen ask, what comes after withdrawal? They're talking about Iraq, moving beyond anti-war politics. They contend that as citizens, we must challenge the U.S. empire. The U.S. troop withdrawal and reparations in Iraq should be accompanied by a declaration of major change in U.S. foreign policy, especially in Iraq and the Middle East. We need a new foreign policy based on justice, relying on international law and the UN, rather than the assertion of might makes right. They also remind us, uncomfortably for those who still harbor illusions about the more liberal wing of our one-party corporate system, that such a vision must move beyond the mendacity of the Bush administration to recognize that similar dreams of conquest and domination have animated every administration, albeit in different forms. From the darling of the anti-communist liberal elite, John F. Kennedy, to the champion of so-called assertive multilateralism, Bill Clinton, to the crude Republican realist, Richard Nixon, and the patron saint of the conservative right, Ronald Reagan, U.S. empire in the post-World War II era has been a distinctly bipartisan effort. They urge us to transcend this ugly history through an honest dialogue and promise of a sea change in U.S. policy. Such empires are typically brought down from outside with great violence, but we have another option. As citizens of that empire who understand how this pathology of power damages our country as well as the world, imagine what would be possible if we, ordinary citizens of this latest empire, could build a movement that gave politicians no choice but to do the right thing. This is a utopian vision that they present that should guide our thoughts and action. Bennis and Jensen have written a passionate and fine article. However, at the same time, we must heed the lessons of the past. A powerful anti-imperialist movement able to stop and destroy the empire has not arisen in our 218-year history, not even during the Vietnam War. We cannot afford to be naive about such prospects now. While we cannot predict the future, we do know what has happened in the past. No such movement has pushed government officials to oppose individual wars, let alone the empire that creates and sustains them. Therefore, we need to be crystal clear about the nature of the empire and the task we face if we wish to dismantle it. The historian Arnold Toynbee addressed this issue in the 1970s. America today is the leader of a worldwide anti-revolutionary movement in defense of vested interests. She now stands for what Rome stood for. Rome consistently supported the rich against the poor in all foreign communities that fell under her sway. And since the poor have always and everywhere been far more numerous than the rich, Rome's policy made for inequality, for injustice, and for the least happiness for the greatest number. He could be writing that today again about the U.S. 37 years later. If we are to challenge the premises and the practices of this empire, we also must have a clear understanding of its utterly brutal and historic role. For those on the liberal left end of the political spectrum, this ultimately means confronting the imperialist actions of the Democratic Party. In the post-World War II era alone, the staggering record of violence against people in the Third World by Democratic presidents, Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, Carter, and Clinton, ought to teach us that savage wars of peace are not a Republican monopoly. U.S. imperial interventions against sovereign countries have tied Democrats and Republicans in a brotherhood of empire. It is a blood brotherhood that will not be changed by remaining in a state of denial about our government's true history. Lest we think that these assertions are too harsh, we can ponder the words of Ralph Peters, former U.S. Army intelligence officer, writing in 2003. He stated, "We are entering a new American century in which we will become wealthier, culturally more lethal, and increasingly powerful. We will excite hatreds without precedent. The de facto role of the U.S. armed forces will be to keep the world safe for our economy." And I added, that means safe for the ruling elites who control our economy. "And open to our cultural assaults," he stated. He concludes by saying, "To these ends, we will do a fair amount of killing." This is the ruthless system we face, the same one that prompted the words of historian Gabriel Coco after the United States invasion of Vietnam. Reflecting upon the truths found in the Pentagon Papers about that war, he wrote the following: "The papers were a singularly overwhelming indictment of how devious, incorrigible, and beyond the pale of human values America's rulers were throughout this epic event in U.S. history. The Republican neocons who now run the empire are no different than their Democratic brothers were during that genocidal Vietnam conflict. Today, as then, they are beyond the pale of human values. To forget this truth is to consign the world's poor to a future of unrelenting terror and tragedy, and to play our role as good Americans in that tragedy. In order to challenge the passive roles we are being asked to play as good Americans to continue the empire, we need a much longer range view of history, perhaps that provided by the marvelous English historian Eric Hobsbawm in his book Interesting Times, A 20th Century Life. He stated, "Living for over 80 years of the 20th century has been a natural lesson in the mutability of political power, empires, and institutions. I have seen the total disappearance of the European empires, not least the greatest of all, the British Empire, never larger and more powerful than in my childhood, when it pioneered the strategy of keeping order in places like Kurdistan and Afghanistan by aerial bombardment. I have seen great world powers relegated to minor divisions, the end of a German empire that expected to last 1,000 years, and of a revolutionary power that expected to last forever. I am unlikely to see the end of the American century, but it is a safe bet that some readers of this book will." End of quote. It is in our power, therefore, to help bring about the end of that century. Thank you for your patience. I mentioned to people, some of you who were here, that it's been kind of a stressful few weeks. My father-in-law just died over the weekend. He's been ill for some time. I've got a kind of a rib injury, so I'm going to take a break, and then we'll come back and discuss things. So thank you.
John, what was the last person
before? It's Eric Hobsbawm, the British historian, who's done a series, Age of Empire, Age of Revolution, and he's got a marvelous, I've started to read it, it's a marvelous biography, autobiography of his life. I'll be back in a few minutes, and then we have plenty of time, and for those of you who came in late, of course, we will go to Izzy's after. Why don't we get started or get restarted or... What I'd like to do is, given that it's the last night, is let people really address these things rather than me feel obligated to respond, because I'm a little shaky tonight. So this way people will get a chance to talk.
What's different? You're always a little shaky.
Yeah, well, that's true. So.
Roll them.
It's just a little slightly different format, as I said. Since I'm not at 100%, and since, but more importantly, that because this is our last meeting, to go around and let people reflect, share some insights, and rather than me often responding, to sort of go from person to person and. You know, I'll jump in from time to time, but this way it'll give everyone who wants an opportunity to have his or her final piece to say it.
Taraj wants to know, oh, he isn't here.
Oh, he had to
he
leave.
Wants to know if we get our money back because it was only a 45-minute lecture tonight.
Yeah, he and I meet at the 18th Street Cafe, so I'll buy his latte or whatever it is.
Yeah, well, what about the rest of us?
Yeah, and the rest of you, you have my email, and so just send me an email.
Send you a bill?
Send me a bill. I'd be happy to send checks.
I'll hand you the microphone, and you want to speak into it just as I'm holding it. Speak as though you're speaking right down a tube, and we'll get the best reception, and you'll be on the air.
Oh, heavens. of course, there's huge amounts to say, but I was disappointed in just looking over the last chapters of the three books that we finished up with tonight. That very little was said about international affairs, about international bodies. There were no comments on my favorite topic, United Nations. Now, it hasn't been so long when that was thought of as the great hope. After, you know, World War II, we had the Universal Declaration of Rights, 1946. And people were concentrating on that. But what's happened to it? Why can't there be such a body? I mean, we certainly need it. And in the absence of a central body where many nations can speak and all have a say, a central power, there will be pressure on the United States to adopt this role of savior, of policeman, of leading humanitarian invasions and so on. Now, that seems to me disastrous and just a recipe for imperialism, inviting the United States to keep with its imperial powers. But I my hope goes in that direction. Not that we shouldn't try internally to improve things, but to try externally as well. Look into the national, international body or bodies.
As I said, what we'll do, we'll go around to a number of people. I'll try and take some notes, and then we can tie some of this together.
Okay. I guess we were thinking along somewhat the same lines, because what I'm thinking of is now we have, there's so much happening in South America, and that the people are taking the reins into their own hands in several of the countries down there. And now we've got Hugo Chavez getting military weapons from Russia. And I just see a clash. I mean, already Bush has tried to control what's going on down in South America, but I think we're going to have our hands full. It's going to be the big battle between empire and the people's people.
Hi, I'm Jay from Santa Monica. Just make a few points. The reference was made to the Four Freedoms by FDR, and one of the authors suggested the fifth freedom was to rob, exploit, and dominate. I challenge that. My recollection is that we did have America Firsters and isolationists pre-World War II. It was by far the majority view and opinion in the U.S. at the time prior to Pearl Harbor to stay out of the war. Sure, we'll give them all the guns and the supplies and weapons and let them help them fight the battle against the Nazis. But at that time, the overwhelming view in the U.S. was not to get involved in World War II, that the idea, as far as world public, at least American public opinion, has had a number of periods of so-called isolationism or nativism or introspective views rather than this global view that we have today. I don't see, just because it's global today, why it cannot and would not be reversed. There are other things happening here. Secondly, is this issue constantly comes up of comparing the United States to Rome. Why Rome? I mean, okay, it's one good example, but it's not the only example. And by using that one example, it tries to prove the point that if Rome was this and that, therefore the United States is this and this. I challenge that. I think that if you look at the process between the Aztecs and the Spanish conquistadors, Catholicism and the Reformation, Turkish Empire for 400 or 500 years prior to World War I, the British German Empire, the Soviet Empire, if you want to call it that, all these are complete different case studies that are equally applicable to United States experiences, not only Rome. So I would like to put Rome in its place where it belongs, which is in a long list of many other empires which we have many things in common, but none of which we are identical to. Next to last, just this comment about world war without end, this phrase, war without end. Now, while we're hearing it lately, where have we heard this before? I think it came up in late 1800s and prior to World War I, the war to end all wars. Remember that? Well, it wasn't. And our war without end that the United States seems to be, and that we are, of course, guilty, if that's the proper phrase, this has been going on since 1950 with Truman post-World War II. There's nothing particularly new today, 2007, than 1957. It's just one long continuation. Well, is it truly a war without end? I would come back to the United Nations comment that the gentleman made. There's a number of other countervailing aspects that it would end. In particular, the superstate phrase that just came out today between Sarkozy of France and Blair and Merkel making secret deals, so-called under-the-table deals in Europe, to basically rewrite and pass a European Union constitution without calling it a treaty. And Blair will be the president of all of Europe. I'm serious. This is the plan that is imminent. They're talking about doing this week or next week. I don't know, for the new superstate. That if you want to talk about what is going to change so that the United States will no longer not only have a war without end, but be the dominator of the planet, this is one perfect example that could easily change our experience in the next few years. Thanks.
Tony Blair, President of Europe. Wow.
Perish the thought. Reflecting back on what we've been learning here for the past few months, it draws to my mind, in this discussion in the last two comments particularly as well, the distinction between the motives of those who have risen to the top of the ruling class and the people, common people at large in any country. And they're quite distinct. And while, you know, there may be some differences between the ruling political elites of various nations, there are more likely to be many more similarities than there are differences amongst them, and much larger differences between them and their populace of their own country. And to me, what this calls for in terms of understanding how to deal with the Iraq war, the Iran war, the next war, Venezuela, or whatever, it's impossible to address these without first a proper grounding in the historical momentum that we're involved in, but then to look at this and say what we need, the reason why the current international bodies are seem somewhat powerless to cease this momentum is because they have been more or less established by the ruling elites of the nation states themselves. So there are built-in loopholes and built-in protected areas and built-in situations where those who need to be brought to account never will be. And that kind of situation is perpetuated, regardless of the power, supposed power of these bodies. So what is needed is not an alliance between the ruling elites of these countries. We already have plenty of those. We need an alliance between the common people who are able to recognize that issues as they stand are not moving in their best interest or anyone's best interest, really, and form an alliance internationally amongst those people. And, you know, this might sound a little bit far-fetched until we pull back from a minute from our national identification and understand who we are and what we're about and how much we have in common with everybody else around the world, like ourselves, who abhor the ways that they're made use of by the ruling elites of their own country. So that's all I want to say.
A couple of points or questions, and each point that people bring up could easily branch into an entire class itself. It's hard to try to put anything in a nutshell in a minute or two. I wanted to point out that the concept of a war without end is the hyper-convenient tool of the ruling class, as it were. As I recall, the drug war of recent and even current past, the drug wars waged in such a way that they maintain a flow of drugs so that they could punish people for drug possession. It's allowed to be brought in, and then you select who you enforce. So it's the perfect perpetual war. It just sort of becomes a tool against the people. So if you have a war on terror, this undefinable, vague terror, what is terror? It's very bad, we know that, but we can't quite define it, nor can we ever define the end of terror, because there's always a potential. So that being the case, we have the opportunity to perpetually enforce a police state and build up our military and police status and more laws. So the opportunity given with a war without end is just, it's crystal. It's crystal clear as a power tool. A question that I would have for you would be, being that we've negated almost every treaty we've signed to date that has to do with torture, rendition, waging wars of aggression, will there be any further relevance to treaties is that just a thing of the past? Because I can't imagine any country taking us credibly. You'll sign a treaty this week, but it will mean nothing. It will have no bearing in the future. Also, I wanted to say that you, one of the authors you cited noted the fall, he had witnessed the falling of the European empires and pointed specifically to the British Empire amongst others. And I would argue that we are merely an arm of the British Empire, even though we are so wrapped in our very different identity and a unique accent and maybe different flavored gum. We are definitely from British roots, even to the point where we still wave the flag of the British East India Trading Company. Not a lot of people pay attention to that little factoid. And lastly, with the unabated power of our monopolized corporate media and a completely funneled and filtered information stream, will the people that have generally... I think the battery may be going out.
Maybe. Let's give me the other mic. I'll put
it in
the
battery.
Switch mic.
Red light. What is the red light?
Low battery.
Okay. Yeah, it's got a funky light on it.
Lastly,
go ahead.
There we go. And this even makes my voice richer and more robust. Thank you.
Speaking of media,
one of the ways that empire have fallen has often been from within, or at least a seed of that destruction has been within, when the poor oppressed masses finally get upset and upset the apple cart. Though with our media and information streams being so very filtered, and the 20 to 30 people in this room being the only people apparently of any independent thought, is there a chance that the people will be involved in ceasing this American empire, or will it be brought about through some economic collapse from outside? What are the hopes? Anyway, thank you.
Test, test, test.
Hello, testing. Yeah, okay. We live in very serious and very interesting times, I guess. I mean, we have all these competing blocks in the global, you know, competing for the global empire. All these elites do have their plans. You know, the neoconservatives and all the different elites around the world have their plans. I was just watching on CNN about how China is spending billions of dollars to upgrade their military. You know, they're doing that in response to what the U.S. is doing. And you've got, well, Jay was talking about Europe, and there's all these other blocks, the Latin America. So they have their plans. I'm hoping that... And they've got lots of money, and they, you know, they're going to use the military. They're going to use all kinds of technology, new technology. If you want to watch something scary, watch the History Channel. They've got a few programs on futuristic technology, you know, that the military is going to use. So they want to do this. They're arrogant. They're you know, they have huge egos about, you know, wanting to control the world. But I'm hoping that it's like that old thing of, and maybe, you know, sure, there are all kinds of particular things that we would need to look at that maybe Rome or the British Empire is different, but they all tend to get greedy and to overexpand themselves, and so that's what I'm hoping for. And it's not only that the people rise up, but, you know, we have international solidarity and work together, and that they overreach themselves, that they run up deficits and run the country into bankruptcy, and things don't go always the way they want. I know what they want in the Middle East right now is for chaos to reign in Palestine and in Iraq. I'm thinking that maybe Daniel Ellsberg is right when he says the surge of 30,000-40,000 people is probably soldiers over there is probably to control the Shiites or whatever when they go into Iran. Right now they just have a new initiative into this part of Iraq that's right next to the border of Iran, right? Just coincidentally. So I think there's a good chance that they're gonna, you know, that they're just gonna fall into a quagmire. I'm hoping for that. Maybe I'm just trying to look for some some sort of light here in the darkness. But what was my other thought? Well, I had another thought. It'll come back to me.
Just a historical point. Rome was a slaveholding military democracy that sprang from a federation of three tribes, went through a period of slavery, and the vestiges of both tribal and slave society continued on while they extracted tribute from the perimeter, and the empire started to fail when the perimeter gained more strength than they were able to handle.
Just maybe briefly, and perhaps actually we might close a bit early tonight so that we can spend more time at Izzy's talking. And
can I throw in one thing on religion first?
Yeah.
Give him the mic. Give him a mic, please.
Oh, all right. Let's
I thought you were going to take it from here.
Let's let everybody who wanted to say something, and then I'll try and respond. And then, as I said, we'll, because I certainly could use something to eat.
Whoever said the meek will inherit the earth was wrong. As we all know, the bottom line is class. The bottom line is class warfare. Any way you want to slice it, the CEOs of the corporations are the ones that are running the world. The outsourcing, the offshoring, we can go on and on about it. And it's never going to end. There's profit in war. This is why we're still in Iraq. So, anyway, that's pretty much what I wanted to say.
Where's the other mic?
Yeah. It's right here. Woody? It would be nice if we could sit back and wait for the inevitable that you hope will happen to happen. But in those countries that are seeing progress, like in South America, the people there, it's not just happening coincidentally. People there are putting their lives on the line. And that's what we're not doing here. We have to be willing to go to jail or to die. I mean, that's how the people, the suffragettes, got where they got and the civil rights movement made advances. People put their lives on the line, you know.
Well, I did mention people rising up, you know.
Yeah.
I did say that.
I mean, it's really going to take that when...
International solidarity.
I think it's going to take that.
Hi, Jay again. Just a comment on religion. We have not talked about the impact of fundamentalist or evangelical religion in this group either tonight, and I don't recall any significant in-depth discussions in the past. I've been convinced since the beginning of the Iraq attack and occupation that it was oil-based, that the whole profit motive and greed was the basis, of course, built on oil. I'm seriously reconsidering that position and seeing it much more in religious terms now, that the impact of fundamentalist evangelical religion within the U.S. military is pervasive, starting at the academy level, going all the way up to the chiefs of staff in the Pentagon. And I have this on excellent authority. There's published books on it. A gentleman named Mikey Weinstein, who was a Republican in the Reagan White House, his books on a speaking tour, itemizing detail by detail how the meetings are open up, you know, with some phrase of the Lord, thy God, and now we'll talk about the bombing mission, et cetera, that the F-16 planes in Georgia have been painted and named as the Crusaders, that the emblem logo they're using is the helmet from 1086 of the Crusaders, that metal helmet, which, of course, was the first crusade, that the sword that was the long English sword, etc. All these comparisons back to the Crusades have in its basic foundation into the Middle East a religious aspect, a religious priority on the ruling class, as getting back to class is what the gentleman said. that it's religion is driving this, and the crusade and the conquest. It's, and the subtext is the oil, the money, the profit, and the greed. But we're dealing with a whole different question here now, because religion is really much more profound at the basis of this than just the dollar signs.
In reference to whoever said the meek shall inherit the earth, that was Jesus. And it looks like the meek have been doing a pretty good job in riling things up in South America, especially Hugo Chavez. He comes from a background of poverty, and he relates to poor people, and I guess that they're in the category of the meek people. The other thing about that Jay said about the Roman Empire, I believe the Roman Empire was the longest enduring empire in history. Can you think of any other empire that endured longer than the Roman Empire? But wasn't the Roman Empire about 1,000 years? 600. 600? Okay, maybe that's why it gets all the credit when as the poster boy for...
Turkey's still a country.
Well, yeah, Italy's still a country too, and Rome's still around, but nevertheless, maybe that's the reason why they always get referred to as the example to be compared to when it comes to empire. Another thing I'd like to make is an observation between Grandin's book and Parenti's book. you know, both these books make me want to give up hope on the human race because of the way our country has victimized people, and our foreign policy is one of being the victimizer. But the interesting thing about Grandin's book that he investigates with detailed accounts on mass slaughters, treachery, covert action, U.S.-sponsored tortures, assassinations, overthrow of democracies through footnotes and documentation, whereas Parenti, he has no footnotes. It's all kind of like his point of view, but it's obviously well-documented point of view. He just doesn't have any footnotes and references. So I see Parenti's book as more of a manifesto, which is fine with me. I mean, Karl Marx made one, had quite an effect. But those are two significant differences I see in his books, these two books. And you mentioned Chomsky. I heard recently that Chomsky made an observation about Animal Farm and something called the Free England. You know anything about that?
No.
His reference to Free England is that even though the story in Animal Farm is about totalitarian states, that the education that comes out of Oxford and Cambridge kind of contributes to totalitarian mentality. Mm-hmm. for example, you take the concept of patriotism. That's across the board. We've kind of been brainwashed with a totalitarian mentality over patriotism that almost everybody, when it comes to patriotism, especially after 9/11, you know, it's my country right or wrong. There's no other definition of patriotism. But that's just not true. There can be many definitions, but they seem to come from weirdos and mavericks and malcontents, such as G.K. Chesterton. He came up with a definition of freedom who said, my country, right or wrong, is like saying my mother drunk or sober. And and it was I think it was George Bernard Shaw said something to the effect that patriotism is a psychotic and pernicious form of idiocy. And my favorite is what was written by Ambrose Bierce in 1911, which I think is more timely today than it was in 1911. His definition of patriotism is that patriotism is combustible rubbish ready to the torch by those ambitious to illuminate their name. And so it seems like change in this world comes from
well, like I say, malcontents and mavericks like Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln or Susan B. Anthony or even Karl Marx,
John Marciano,
throw him in there too, and Fidel Castro, Dennis Kucinich, Al Gore, and maybe Michael Moore.
And maybe Michael Ferenczi.
Righto.
The full quote is, "My country right or wrong, when right kept right, when wrong set right." That's the full quote. Of course, Goldwater and the right wingers just used the first phrase.
Let me just make a couple of, well, Jack had a comment, and then let me make a couple of comments because my rib is really acting up, and maybe a little of that mushroom barley soup will help it at Izzy's. And because I can't really do justice to the issues that people raised tonight, and in a sense, you've raised the issues that we've discussed and bantered back and forth. Let Jack have a final word, and then just a couple of things, and then we'll close it tonight.
Okay, just two very brief points. One, it seems to me the point of view, of course, regarding imperialism, including empire, was something that I was aware of before I came to the course, and I'm sure it's true with almost everybody here. For me, the main additional point that came across is that I had a sense that a lot of the imperialism, empire kind of stuff was more or less contemporary, 20th century, recent American history, the way the country has evolved. And I think the main insight that I've gotten from the course is that these trends and tendencies and activities were there very early on, at the beginning of the country and through on and through. So it extended it back. It put it into the general fabric of the society historically almost from the beginning. So, all right, that was a particular insight. Okay, a concern I have is, you know, I still think that a lot of ideals based on the beginning of this country are really wonderful ideals. I think the founding fathers, intellectuals, scholars, etc., have made a wonderful case for freedom, democracy, civil liberties, civil rights, equality. I think these things are important in American life and in American society, despite everything that was said. You know, they don't vitiate anything that was said. But I think they're important. They're motivating for people. There have always been people's movements, as Zinn points out, in this country, also since the beginning, that were based on these American ideals, that drew from them and caused people to take action and to improve society and so forth. So, and these were ideals that have influenced people around the world in a positive direction. Ho Chi Minh, you know, took American ideals as a kind of foundation stone for himself. So I can get awful depressed from the course. maybe of necessity, there's this negative, dreadful quality to things. But there is a good side to America. I just don't want to lose that. So I just want to say that before we end.
All right. Let me have one brief comment. And first, two books that I finished very recently that if I had to reorganize the course, we might have read, that I would urge you to read because they address all of the issues we've discussed. One of them is Chalmers Johnson's last of the trilogy, his book Nemesis, which is a powerful but very depressing book. Be aware. The other is V.J. Prashad, P-R-A-S-H-A-D, his book, The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. I think the two of them together are incredible. And to really see this in an internationalist perspective about the rise of the Third World, a non-aligned movement. And just the final thought in our ongoing respectful but sort of disagreeing emphasis about the U.S. that in terms of issues that Jack has raised for us to think, that all of us in this room, at least those of us raised in the U.S., were profoundly shaped by the ideals, especially of the Declaration of Independence. But I would suggest respectfully that not one of the founding fathers, except for Thomas Paine, who is never considered to be a founding father, not one of the ideals, democracy, equality, decency, came about because of the founding fathers and the government, but because of those who resisted the government. If you recall that in 1789, the only people who could vote were wealthy white men of property. Every extension that we now take dear in this country was resisted. Every one of those ideals, which I would call the anti-resistance, and I've made this point a number of times, and I will just leave you with it. From the freeing of the slaves, the abolitionist movement, the women's movement in 1848, the second women's movement, the anti-war movements, the struggle for health care, for worker safety, every one of those movements in the country had to fight the founding fathers and the leaders of this country. And as articulated, this has always been a class warfare issue that has had racial and gender dynamics. And that issue goes on. So think about it. Let's go eat. I need to get something to eat. So thank you.
You have been listening to Empire as a Way of Life, a lecture and discussion series given by Dr. John Marciano. This group meets monthly until June of 2007 at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the Internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio, the digit 4, all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.